fishing all of the time. Baby going fishing too. Bet your life, your sweet wife will catch more fish than you. Lady Blues.
Tired of fishing around in the waters and waves of FM morning radio and reeling in nothing but the same old bottom feeders and boring repeats? Try Fishing with Boston from 9 to 11 Tuesday mornings on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph and catch a wide range of new releases and vintage classics that other stations are too redundant to play. And don't forget the internet, check CFRU.ca for events listings, live worldwide broadcasting, and archives of the past 4 weeks of programming.
I'm a going fishing, mama's going fishing, and the baby going fishing too.
The Guelph Jazz Festival will begin its volunteer recruitment for the 2010 season. The festival runs from September 8th until September 12th. Many positions are still available. For more information, please contact www.guelphjazzfestival.com or volunteer at guelphjazzfestival.com. Come make happen one of Canada's most influential music festivals.
Welcome to Grand Rire Community Radio News. This week, Grand Rire comes to you from CKUT Radio in Montreal. I'm Lauren.
I'm Joel.
First, national news.
July 24th marked a National Day of Action against Federal Minister of Citizenship, Multiculturalism, and Immigration, Jason Kenney. Under Kenney's leadership, Immigration Canada increased the number of people it deports and lessen the number of asylum seekers and sponsored family members it permits into the country. Kenney banned British PM George Galloway for entering Canada for his vocal opposition to the war in Afghanistan and the occupation of Palestine. He removed remarks about LGBTQ rights from Canada's citizenship guide, and, controversially, he pulled Canada out of the Durban World Conference on Racism. Over 8,000 people have joined the Facebook group called Canadians Calling for the Resignation of Jason Kenney.
From the East Coast, Grand Rire has been following the story of toxic dumping in the Pictou Landing Boat Harbour First Nation in Nova Scotia. The Chief and Council of Pictou Landing First Nation have filed a notice to sue this month against the Nova Scotia provincial government for their negligence in their responsibility to clean up toxic waste in nearby Boat Harbour. The industrial wastewater treatment facility located at Boat Harbour, owned by Northern Pulp, has been dumping toxic influent into the lagoon since it began operating in 1967. In a letter dated December 2008, the provincial government of NDP, Darrell Dexter, acknowledged its own responsibility to clean up the mess in the Boat Harbour lagoon. In March of 2010, the province lent $75 million to Northern Pulp to help the company secure a wood supply for its pulp and paper mill, allowing it to continue operating. The Pictou Landing lawsuit will ask for an injunction to shut down the Boat Harbour treatment facility. The Chief and Council will be able to commence the lawsuit on August the 31st.
The Manitoba Court of Appeals has issued a roadblock for Métis to overcome along their road to the Supreme Court of Canada. In a departure from a 1990 Supreme Court of Canada decision, the court questioned the Manitoba Métis Federation's standing and its ability to address constitutional issues. Manitoba's highest court did, however, acknowledge the fiduciary relationship between the Crown and the Métis. It also asserted that Métis do in fact hold Aboriginal title, something an earlier judge disputed. The Manitoba Métis Federation president, David Chartrand, said, quote, "We are disappointed, but we were by no means defeated. Based on the history of lower court Aboriginal land-related decisions, we had expected this outcome. It was also understood that no matter who won, this was going to go to the Supreme Court." End quote. The Métis say that the federal government has not lived up to its end of the Manitoba Act, a Métis federal government treaty struck in 1870.
To the West Coast now, where the BC Civil Liberties Association believes that an RCMP investigation into a hate crime in the town of Lake Cowichan, BC is fatally flawed. Catherine Fisher from CGLY in Nelson has more details.
In March of this year, some person or persons spray-painted an anti-gay slur on the fence surrounding Lake Cowichan resident Bill Hansen's home. Hansen, who has a security camera installed on his property, believes that the camera captured the culprits on film. Individuals visible in the footage have been identified as an off-duty RCMP auxiliary officer and a Lake Cowichan town employee. The video footage shows the men in the vicinity of the fence, but sometimes they drop out of the picture and it is often unclear what they are up to. It is known that the pair were working at the time, and in possession of work-issued blue spray paint cans, which they were using to paint the town wellheads near the fence around the time of the tag's appearance. The offending tag on the fence was also done in blue spray paint. Henson reported his suspicions about the men to the local RCMP, who promised to investigate the matter thoroughly. Samples of the paint used in the tag were sent to the lab for analysis, but the results are not expected to be released until December of this year. In spite of this delay, Corporal Darren Lagan of the Lake Cowichan RCMP reported in late May that the RCMP investigation has shown there is no evidence to link the two men in any way to this act of graffiti. The video evidence submitted by the victim in no way shows any criminal acts being committed by the town employees. The BC Civil Liberties Association has expressed concern about the due diligence of the Lake Cowichan RCMP investigating the incident involving one of their own members. The association considers the closing of the investigation to be premature, as material evidence important to the investigation has not yet been tested. The BCCLA also states that the RCMP has made public statements that the video of the allegedly involved individuals clearly shows that the Lake Cowichan employees did not commit any mischief to the property, even though much of the activity of the employees behind the fence is not visible in the video. The BC Civil Liberties Association is also concerned with a statement made by the incident's investigating officer to the complainant. The officer in question said that she believed that she did not need to verify Lake Couch and RCMP claims about the incident because they are police officers and they would not lie to her. Executive Director of the BCCLA, David Ebby, says that whether or not the Lake Couch and staffers are to blame for the graffiti isn't the association's debate. Their complaint is with the flawed RCMP investigation which has followed it. BCCLA President Robert Holmes believes that a thorough and complete investigation and public report is required for the benefit of the accused, the accuser, and the public. This is Catherine Fisher, reporting for Groundwire.
Last year, Groundwire reported the establishment of Lou's Pharmacy, an all-women's pharmacy located in Vancouver. This month, Lou's Pharmacy will close its doors. Frieda Worden from CJSF reports on a first in feminist pharmaceutical care in Canada.
1 year after it opened, Lou's, a pharmacy for women, is no more. The Vancouver Women's Health Collective, which created the pharmacy, still occupies the premises at 29 West Hastings Street on Vancouver's downtown east side. However, they found they were unable to raise enough money to keep the pharmacy open. A pharmacist is very expensive, said collective member Natalie Richards, and you have to keep it staffed a lot of hours. She said the collective had held fundraisers and that the customer base had been increasing each month, but not yet enough to support the social enterprise. Lou's Pharmacy had become a focus of transgender activists because of its women-only mission. After a series of meetings with some of the activists, the Vancouver Women's Health Collective decided to change its policy to include all self-identified women. They changed their policy, but they didn't issue a formal apology, said trans activist Jamie Lee Hamilton on June 19th. So, no one in the community will support them. Vancouver Women's Health Collective still offers nurse practitioner services and access to other women's health resources at the 29 West Hastings Street location. The collective is open to all self-identified women.
Groundwire will return after this break.
On the ground, in your community. Groundwire is a listener-supported project of the National Campus Community Radio Association. Support community radio news. Support Groundwire by donating now at ncra.ca.
Back to Grand Raya Community Radio News, grassroots stories from coast to coast. Now time for our feature stories. This week we continue to bring you the voices of Indigenous resistance.
On Monday, July 13th, at approximately 7 p.m., oil from Canada's steamship line's vessel, the MV Richelieu, spilled into the St. Lawrence Seaway. The CSL press conference stated that the engine motor failed, causing the ship to be adrift in the middle of the seaway. Whilst floating, the freighter dropped its anchor, and at that time, a wind squall came from the St. Lawrence River, which forced the vessel into its own anchor. The impact punctured the hull of the MV Richelieu, which allowed for the oil to spill into the seaway. Stuart Mayo, a Wolf Clan representative from the Mohawk Traditional Council of Ganawage, does not buy the CSL version of what happened to the ship. He explains that due to the water levels of the seaway, the weight of the vessel, and the position of the freighter vis-a-vis the St. Lawrence River, the MV Richelieu could not have collided that easily with its own anchor. Mayo suggests that the repairs done earlier to one of the fuel injectors may have been at the root of the problem.
So for us, when we look at it, we don't believe it. You know, number one, it's fine and dandy that they gave their official story, but the official story seems to have a lot of holes in it. We got to wonder if there's an investigation looking into the repairs that were done earlier that day.
What is also missing from the official story is the explanation of how the oil spilled into the St. Lawrence River. The Eastern Canada Response Corporation, the environmental specialist hired by the CSL to clean the waterway, was not yet finished with clearing the oil from the rocks and the surrounding coastline when the seaway locks were opened, allowing ships to enter and leave, and simultaneously permitting the oil spill to expand from the contained area of the seaway to the river.
The respective agencies responsible for opening those locks have totally disregarded the health and welfare of not only the people, but also of our Mother Earth and her waterways. But what we say is the reason why they opened those locks is that they were acting on pressure to get the ships that were waiting to come in before this strike occurred with the longshoremen. So it seems like this is what they've done to accommodate economic interests, the health and welfare of the people have been compromised. So that's why we say this is criminal. Whoever decided to open up those locks before the cleanup was done, that person, that agency, they should be held criminally responsible for this.
For Groundwire, this is Natalia Avdakimova reporting from CKUT in Montreal.
One of the most controversial mines in Canadian history is under review in British Columbia. Last April, two Victoria-based independent journalists traveled to Williams Lake and a remote Chilcotin community in the Nemanja Valley to gain a better understanding of how residents feel about Prosperity Mine. They found a community that is grappling with a difficult question. Who gets to determine whether a mining boom is worth a potential bust? This is part two of Losing Ground.
Taseko Mine's proposed Prosperity Mine would be located 800 kilometers northwest of Vancouver, near the city of Williams Lake. It's one of the most contentious mine proposals in Canadian history. Taseko's plan to convert nearby Fish Lake into a dump site for the mine's toxic waste is enabled by Schedule 2, an amendment to the Fisheries Act which allows mining corporations to use certain freshwater lakes across Canada as tailings impoundment areas. The Tsilhqot'in First Nation have been at the forefront of the opposition to the mine, but Prosperity Mine has found support in nearby Williams Lake, a resource-based city facing rising poverty. We traveled to the city of Williams Lake and the nearby First Nations community of Namaya Valley, two communities at the epicenter of the debate, to find out how the cost and benefits of mining are calculated in such a complex and contested case.
And they're going to dispose of their mine waste and tailings into a dammed up portion of the lake as fish compensation for taking Fish Lake. They're going to create a new lake called Prosperity Lake.
Chief Joe Alphonse, Tlingit Government Office, NM Indian Reserve. Fish Lake Talton B. It's very near and dear to the heart of all Chilcotin people. A lot of our members used to go into that area for ceremonial purposes, for spiritual purposes. When young people would be coming of age, they would seek to have a vision. Often that was one of the locations they were brought to, and that's where they would get their rite of passage. It's also a ceremonial site. There's burial grounds there. There's cremation site. Before European contact, we didn't bury our people. We cremated them. You know, on a rainy day, whatever, you see white flakes around. Now, those are generally remains of our ancestors. So that area specifically it's very sacred to our people. You gut out a nation and you take their spirituality away. A lot of our families will make $8,000 to $10,000 a year, and that's it. And they're able to do that because they can go down to the rivers and still be able to pull fish out of the waters. When we look at our backyard there, you look at our rivers, you look at our fish, you're looking at our refrigerator system. That's where we store our food, and that's what we need to continue to do. You have the last large wild sockeye salmon run left, and you're on the verge, on the cusp of destroying that. You know, scientists all over the world are constantly warning about this type of things, and we have to change our behavior. We have to start looking after the environment. At some point, the environment will quit looking after us.
Why did you decide to do a presentation today?
Because this is our lives. Because we don't want Fish Lake poisoned.
Fish Lake is important to us.
The earth is better than gold.
Water is going to save us and gold will not. It only gives us jobs.
Find gold up your nose.
The voices you've been listening to were recorded over the course of 4 days in Namaya Valley. The mine is creating a fracture across the region. The city of Williams Lake, located 100 kilometers down a gravel road east of Namaya Valley, has been hard hit by the pine beetle and declining softwood lumber markets. The idea of a mine-induced job bonanza is welcomed by many, but the story is not as cut and dry as it seems. Williams Lake Mayor Carrie Cook explains.
Williams Lake is the hub of the Cariboo. We are primarily resource-based community. We are dependent on forestry, mining, ranching. We have a population of about 11,000 people. We know we have to diversify. We're looking at, you know, an integrated approach to long-term planning and doing a number of things differently. But when people are hurting at the level that they're hurting, and I'll just give you some stats, you know, with our local food bank, it has seen increases of 300%. We've seen increases of 500 to 600% with new families accessing, you know, our food social network. This is costing our local community almost $30,000 a month. We're not naive to think that prosperity is going to solve all of our problems in Williams Lake. That would be like saying that money buys happiness. And so I certainly don't believe that.
Have they given you concrete numbers?
No, we don't have those concrete numbers. So what we're doing is, again, building a relationship and trying to ensure that our voice is heard and our concerns are heard.
I'm Walter Cobb. I'm actually the Vice President of the Chamber of Commerce. I'm a private business person here in Williams Lake and have been in business since 1969. We're in dire straits here. There are many, many businesses that are hurting, and there's a lot of people that are unemployed, and we need to get them back working. We need some sort of economic development. If we don't have it, it will be pretty grim, because we're looking at the downfall period of our forest industry because of the pine beetle. We're probably going to see a couple of mills close, more unemployment, so it looks pretty bleak.
Excuse me, can we ask you a couple of questions about Prosperity Mine?
I haven't really heard the full story on it, but according to the latest studies, they say that that lake will not be in any way harmed, or the watersheds. And as far as Fish Lake is concerned, the natives do not use it anyway. And the reason I'm for it is because we need the industry here in Williams Lake with a downturn of the lumber industry. And there's no reason why it should not go ahead.
It's only the people that are going to profit from it financially that want it. The guys are driving the big shiny red pickups and got to pay for them somehow. I've been here a lot of years, and Williams Lake is resilient. It always comes back. We're not opening mines every day and ruining the countryside, polluting the water and screwing up, you know. Sure, we could use some more jobs, but it's not the most important thing in the world.
Back at the hearings in Namaya Valley, we wondered how the governments of Canada and of BC can even consider mega-projects like Prosperity without meaningful consultation of the Tsilhqot'in. We found that this question is couched in the much bigger issue of First Nations rights and title in Canada. According to the latest court rulings, the Heniquatin have 50% of the title and 100% of hunting and trapping rights in the 4,400 square kilometer area. But the issue of title is currently under appeal in the courts. And in the meantime, the Tsilhqot'in are in a tough spot trying to make the case to protect their lands.
My name is Roger William. Right now I've been working as a Tsleil-Kotlin Land and Stewardship Director. I learned English in the residential school. You know, we've been in a title case for 20 years. Fish Lake right now is not in a proven title area, but it's inside our declaration rights to hunt, to trap, to trade, and also to catch and use wild horses. BC or Canada can approve a project, whether it's title or rights, declaration or proven, for the betterment of the country. So now, if you don't have no proven rights or title, they can provide opportunities. There's different agreements that you can use. But if you have title and you have rights, that damage has to be paid for any First Nations.
My name is Ivor Myers, Chief of Unacitin Government. The Tsleil-Kotlin Nation, the people themselves, have the final say, not the federal government.
But for the moment, the federal government does seem to have the final say. One of the primary critiques of environmental assessment processes in Canada is the way in which they impose colonial decision-making processes on First Nations communities. Chief Marilyn Baptiste explains.
This process is foreign to our people. Our people do not agree that we should have to prove that this is our home, that this land, the water, and the animals should be protected. We shouldn't have to prove that.
I'm Margaret Lulua. I work with the Tsleil-Kotlin National Government. Within my job, I've dealt with a lot of different engagement requests that have been made within our traditional territories. The companies come in, we give them our views, but it doesn't really matter. To them, that's consultation. They can take it, but they don't have to use it.
We know this area, we know how to look after it, so to come in and drill a hole for the benefit of a few years, what's 20 years? It's devastating, we don't want to take that risk.
For my children and the people of Huntingwood-Ian and for sustainability, I would stand up and won't let them in.
I do not think this mine will go through. Our people have always stood up and protected our territory, and we're continuing that legacy carried on from our forefathers, and we will continue.
What if this is your backyard? What if this lake had your history and your connection? And I just want to let people in BC and Canada know, if they can make this pristine lake that we still use today, we have historical sites, we have special connection to it, and we have ceremonial, spiritual process still happening every year, and it's going to be gone for a 20-year mining life for the money, for gold, for copper. What if this was your backyard? What do you feel? Do you agree with this?
This documentary was recorded in Namaya Valley and Williams Lake in British Columbia. The voices we heard are among the people who testified in the Federal Environmental Assessment Panel review of Taseko Mine's controversial Prosperity Mine project. For more information, point your browser to www.savefishlake.ca.
That was part two in a two-part documentary called Losing Ground, The Struggle for Tizan Binifish Lake. Thanks to producer Tamara Herman and Susie Porter-Bopp for that report.
And now, an exclusive interview from Voice Prince Contact Program. Miss Wesley Eskimo discusses the origin of the residential schools and her own family's experience with the school. She looks at the perception of the schools and how First Nation peoples were seen as second-class citizens. Miss Wesley Eskimo is an assistant professor of Aboriginal Studies at the University of Toronto.
Eventually it became law that they had to send these children to school.
And in this, the residential school setting, their traditions, their religion, everything was removed.
Oh, it was villainized, absolutely. They were told that their parents were heathens and that their religions were improper, they were evil, and they were told a lot of different kinds of things in order to get them to conform. So that was really the most damaging piece of the whole thing. They did learn to read and write, and, you know, my mother went to residential school for 8 years, and, you know, she says, I benefit from the fact that I learned how to do all those things and I got a good work ethic and all those pieces. However, I didn't grow up with my mother, and I lost some of those connections with my family that I would have had if I'd been able to stay home.
But it was very important that there be no native expression. correct?
Oh, not in the schools, no. But, of course, people still maintain it on the in the communities and on the reserves. They were able to take it underground and actually retain it. And I think that's been one of the saving graces in today's society is that Aboriginal peoples did that. And we have a lot of elders, not, well, I shouldn't say a lot, but we have elders out there that have been able to retain those languages and cultures, ceremonialism, and are reteaching it to people. I mean, even I go to school now with an elder, and I'm 51. So, I mean, we're all trying very hard to get that back so that we can continue to pass it down to our children and grandchildren.
You mentioned about your mum being in a residential school system. What did you learn about that growing up?
Well, I learned that there was something terribly wrong with the community in which I was born into because there was so much violence and there was a lot of alcoholism in the communities. And a lot of the people that I grew up with were in the city. I grew up in Toronto, had come from residential schools all over the place. And so there was a lot of acting out. And I really didn't understand that because I grew up in Toronto, I also went to other people's homes and I didn't see the same kinds of things happening there that I saw in my household. So for me, that was a real big question in my mind. What happened and why is it that people behave this way? And it set me on a path to learning about those kinds of experiences that they had. And I was almost sent to residential school myself when I was about 14, and that's about the time the school that she went to closed.
I see.
So I sort of got a reprieve there. But there was certainly a move to try to children weren't sent to school. You know, there was a lot of stuff going on in our communities. It's still going on to a certain extent, even though we've come a long way, that broke families apart quite early on.
Eskimo is an assistant professor of Aboriginal Studies at the University of Toronto. That interview was provided to Grant Ryer, courtesy of VoicePrint. To hear this interview in its entirety, please visit their website at voiceprintcanada.com or call VoicePrint at 1-800-567-6755, extension 226.
And now it's time for the Community Radio Report. This week, the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, the CRTC, released a decision that will provide stable funding for community radio in Canada for the very first time. More than $750,000 each year will go towards the Community Radio Fund of Canada to help support stations. The money was part of a larger policy that governs the sector. Groundwire spoke with the three groups representing community radio in Canada. Here's Shelley Robinson of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, Martin Bougie, Executive Director of the Association des Radiodiffuseurs Communautaires du Québec, and François Côté, Executive Director of Alliance des Radios Communautaires du Canada.
My name is Shelley Robinson, and I'm the Executive Director of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. There's a number of new and encouraging things that the CRTC just released in their update to the Campus and Community Radio Policy. The big one that lots of people are talking about is the fact that the sector has got money for the first time. The Community Radio Fund of Canada is now eligible, and it will in fact be mandated to get a certain percentage of the Canadian Content Development Contributions. So it's going to equal over $700,000 a year. So that's huge. Internally, sort of within community radio stations, there's also some other big changes that happen. So, for instance, we always used to be defined as an alternative to the commercial and the public radio broadcasting sector, and now we don't have that same sense of being defined by what we're not, but they defined us more positively as what we are, which is by virtue of our structure, so non-profit, public access, driven by volunteers for the most part. So that was also a really great thing. There are some other things that we as a sector asked for. So, for instance, we asked for spectrum to be reserved for community stations in communities that don't already have a station. The CRTC came back and said, well, we're not the right ones to do that. That's the governor and council. So for as to what's next is we're going to be taking that request to the governor and council.
I'm François Côté. I'm Secretary General of Alliance des Radios Communautaires du Canada. We decided that the three big associations of community radios in Canada should work together toward the new policy for community radio on campus. We did a very, very good job in front of the CRTC. The first big success for us would be financing. The fact that the CRTC recognized that our sector was underfunded was the biggest news of the new policy.
Martin Bougie, Executive Manager from Quebec Community Radio Association. It just made sense for us to sit at the same table and speak one voice for the old sector. We all sit in markets where it's hard to just to just finance the mission, and this mission has a cost. When you want to provide good services, good local services, local information and such, well, this has a cost. I think it's worth mentioning, too, that there is a little line in the definition that just says that community campus radio is a guaranteed local radio service.